I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude is what we do. This one's about inequality on the rise in the U.S. It picks up on the thread of the American exception, ways in which we've always been unlike other world societies. We've worshipped equal opportunity and middle-class values and, at the same time, strike-it-rich success. The tide today, when it rises, lifts mainly yachts. In 21st century America, not only are the rich getting richer, the super rich are pulling away from the shrinking middle and the sullen lower classes. Not the American way exactly, but not entirely new either. It reminds the historically minded of the great expansion of wealth and inequality in the 1880s. The Rockefeller, Vanderbilt, some say robber baron era, the Gilded Age that Mark Twain helped bring down by ridicule. My guest, Chuck Collins, would love to do as much. He's a writer and analyst at the Institute of Policy Studies in Washington and at the website extremeinequalities.org. Chuck Collins, we speak of this new century as the second Gilded Age. CEOs making vast multiples of their workers' wages. It's the era of the hedge fund as the definitive rich guy getting richer. Help us get objective about what's actually happening to the gap between the rich, the poor, and everybody in the middle.
Well, you call it the second Gilded Age, Chris, which I think is a useful way to think about it, that we, 100 years ago, lived in a period of extreme inequality. But then, after World War II, we had this 30-year period where we really did grow together, where we became a mass middle-class society, where the rising tide pretty much did lift all the boats. And so what's happened is, since the mid-70s, we've begun to pull apart again, both in terms of incomes, what people's earnings are, but also in terms of savings and wealth. That more and more of that wealth is pooling up at the top. The middle is getting more stretched and stressed out, so needing to work longer hours just to sort of hold steady. And the poor pretty much hasn't moved, or savings. Some people have fallen off the net worth train, if you will. They now owe more than they own, and they are deeper in debt. So we're seeing a stressing on lower and middle income people in the last 30 years, which is a new piece of the story.
How do you account for the fluctuation? I mean, first of all, the rise of equality as a standard, as a reality in mid-century America. Was that Roosevelt? Was it the war? Was it equal misery in the Depression? I mean, and then the new trend. Why did it start in the mid-70s, even before Ronald Reagan? Why did it accelerate during Bill Clinton's presidency?
Well, in terms of the how did the first Gilded Age end? It's an interesting question, which is, you know, you've visited the Newport Mansions. You know what the 1880s, 1890s Gilded Age looked like. How did we go from there to this middle-class expansion society? It was a combination of the war, but more to the point, there were social movements that pressed for taxation. We started to tax inheritances. We started to tax high incomes after World War I. We did go through a depression, but there was highly, highly progressive taxation. And there was public investment in lifting the floor, raising the ladder, creating the ladder, if you will. So things like the GI Bill after World War II, first-time homebuyer loans, the FHA, Farmers Home, Veterans Administration mortgages that got millions of people on the wealth-building train. So essentially, we tax the top, and we made real investments that raised the floor, and that helped explain the growing together after World War II. In terms of what happened in the mid-70s, I think people say there's sort of two key things that happened. One is we entered a new phase in the global economy, where the U.S. was competing more head-to-head with European countries after World War II, which had been rebuilding. But the other thing was that there was a real break in the social contract between employers and employees, between corporations and their workers, meaning in those 30 years after World War II, there was a little bit of let's share the gains of productivity. But after like the mid-70s, there was a desire, a need to, for corporations, from their point of view, to go more lean and mean, pit U.S. workers against workers in other parts of the world in a race to the bottom to bring wages down and increase profits. Mm-hmm. The decline of organized labor as a the decline of their clout in the democracy. So in 1955, you know, 30-40% of every workers of the workforce was in a union, and so public policies were more concerned about what was life like for wage earners. So there were a couple of things that happened in the mid-70s, even before Ronald Reagan was elected, that began this 30-year process of pulling apart. So all of those things shifted and began to shift. And then as and with the Reagan era beginning, 1980-81, you then started to see more public policies that were aimed at cutting taxes for the top, increasing benefits for wealth holders, undermining opportunity for wage earners. So the gap between wealth holders and wage earners started to pull apart there. What one Business Week reporter called the triumph of capital and the betrayal of work. Public policies boosted asset ownership, return to assets, and pushed down return to wages.
Chuck Collins, I wanted to talk with you about it partly because James Q. Wilson said in a conversation the other day, Americans don't really care about equality. It doesn't run deep in our psyche and our history. What about it?
I think what he said was Americans don't care about inequality if they believe that it's come about by virtue of merit, come about fairly, or as long as the pie is expanding.
He did say that. Nobody resents Warren Buffett's wealth or Bill Gates's.
Michael Jordan, where you sort of see there's a relationship between somebody's effort and the benefits that they've received. But I think that a lot of people are, what's starting to change is that people are starting to understand that these inequalities, not the inequality of an effort, say, between you and I, but the inequalities, these extreme inequalities, really are not rooted in differences in individual effort. They're really rooted in deep shifts in the whole economy, in the way the rules of the economy have changed. So you got up this morning, you were reading the Greeks, probably in Greek, you probably did your 150 push-ups. Meanwhile, I was sleeping because I was up late listening to the ball game. Each of us have this experience of that there's differences in individual effort, there's differences in individual creativity applied to different problems, and that we are going to be a society that, by virtue of those inequalities of that make us different, will be unequal. But the extreme inequalities come because the rules of the economy have been tipped to benefit asset owners at the expense of wage earners. Tax policy, trade policy, what government does, whether it supports raising the minimum wage or keeps it down. And then there are these differences that have to do with totally unrelated to individual effort, but just the circumstances of where people are born. The advantages of family, of community, of opportunities that sort themselves out. So, you know, we like to think that we have some sort of starting gate equality, or we're aspiring toward a starting gate equality where everybody's, you know, gets a shot. But we're so far from that, from achieving starting gate equality. I mean, my daughter, who, you know, is growing up in a household, you know, with a lot of privileges and advantages, it's very different than another child I know growing up in inner city Detroit, where I grew up. There, by the age of 6 or 7, they're at such different places in terms of it. So the conversation about inequality is, I would say, a little impoverished, both in terms of why we're in this situation as well as what we can do about it.
Let me just say, I think this inequality problem gnaws at us. It's kind of an undigested problem at a gut level. Where should we be hearing about it in the great educational process of the political campaign, this presidential campaign?
I think it's one of the most important conversations that we're not having. It's almost as if we can talk about middle class, the experience of the middle class, but we can't talk about poverty and we can't talk about the concentration of wealth. There's something off limits about that. There's something about our our national language about class, which is just sort of, we don't know how to talk about it. It's so under the surface of the election. I mean, the whole who's elite, who's an elitist and who's not, who has how many houses and who doesn't, who understands the needs of ordinary working people, and who, the subtext is about class and inequality. But the direct engagement with how has this happened? What does it mean? Hmm. What should we do about it? Is really not part of the conversation.
Break it open, Chuck. Where would we begin talking about what we know is eating at our vitals, eating at our morale?
Well, I think it's right. I think you said it right there, which is we need to realize this is putting at risk the American experiment in self-governance to the extent that our country was founded on the notion of rejecting aristocracy, rejecting hereditary wealth and power. We're now creating a very wealthy, powerful dynasty class that has the power to shape the culture, to shape the rules of the economy, and to undermine the quality of life and pretty much all that we care about. So the risks of extreme inequality are very, very high. And if you again, going back to the first Gilded Age 100 years ago, there was a much more robust discussion about these inequalities than we're having today. Meaning, if you think about Theodore Roosevelt and Andrew Carnegie weighed in on the dangers of inequality, but the populist agrarian rebellion, the urban reformers, the early labor movements, people were saying these inequalities are endangering this fragile Republican experiment. Louis Brandeis, who was not at that time a Supreme Court justice, said, we can have concentrated wealth in the hands of a few, or we can have democracy, but we cannot have both. People saw it in very stark terms. And we don't quite have that moral leadership right now that's standing up and saying, health, this is affecting our public health. This is affecting our aspirations of equality of opportunity. This is destabilizing the economy. Inequality in and of itself, it's not just about the rich guy and the person in the middle and the person at the bottom. It's sort of like, what does it do to the whole society? Using somewhat religious language, it leads to a breakdown in solidarity. The notion that the other American ideal, which is we're in the same boat. An injury to one is an injury to all. What happens to you does affect me. We are one body. And if you're in deep distress, that will somehow have an effect on me.
Speaking of unimaginable wealth, you wrote a book with, of all people, Bill Gates Sr., a manifesto in favor of inheritance taxes. Explain that. How did that happen? And what was the argument?
Well, what's interesting is that there are people who are in that top tier who see the dangers, just as we're talking about, see the dangers of inequality to the society. They may be on the winning side, if you will, of the benefits of this economy are accruing to them, but they understand that it really wasn't all of their work that led to their good fortune. And what was interesting about Bill Gates' dad, here's the father of at the time he was the wealthiest man on the planet. He grew up in a working class Bellingham, Washington, worked in his dad had a little furniture store. He fought in World War II and got the GI Bill, went to the University of Washington Law School on the GI Bill, and went into law practice, and had a prosperous life, and his son was fortunate, and his son went to Harvard, almost graduated, and was very successful. He would be the first person to tell you that his son, as smart and hardworking as his son is, did not earn all of that wealth alone. It was a function of growing up in a society, a particular society that has a lot of commonwealth, that has a lot of public investment in research and education and infrastructure and technology and all these things that we do together to make this a good society. So his view is, he thought an inheritance tax was a righteous tax, a fully, beautifully American tax, which is to say, blessings on you now that you've made all this money. But if you make this much, you know, if you make over $5 million or $10 million or $50 million or billions of dollars, you have an obligation to pay back the society that made your wealth possible. And part of how our conversation is a little impoverished, if I might just mention, is this mythology of how wealth is created. We have what I would call the great man theory of wealth creation. I somehow got up this, you know, on this day and worked hard and nobody helped me, and I, you know, started this enterprise and I borrowed capital and I didn't get any help from government and I didn't get any subsidies and I somehow earned $10 million. And there's part of that narrative which is true, which is individual effort matters. Individual creativity matters. We should celebrate that. But the part that's missing is there's all this commonwealth. There's all this societal investment that also makes that possible. And in some ways is uniquely American in the sense of the, you know, we have 200 years of investing in these commonwealth institutions, this knowledge inheritance that we all receive, this technological inheritance. None of us, you know, none of us built the infrastructure. Mm. Many of us weren't alive when the investments were made that made our lives as good as they are today. So we're really good at acknowledging or seeing the individual contribution to wealth creation, and we're almost oblivious to the ways in which society makes it all possible. And Bill Gates is very, he calls the estate tax, the inheritance tax, he says it's the gratitude tax. Mm. It's the tax you pay back as a person who's prospered in the society so that other people can have the same opportunity.
In my lifetime, it seems to me there's been an erosion of this kind of anti-feudal, vaguely fraternal, mixed equal opportunity society into a hedge fund world. Are we risking our identity as a middle-class society, a regular Joe six-pack sort of world?
Yeah, I think we are. I mean, I think people who have a living memory of growing up in the 50s and 60s, and not to romanticize this, there was, you know, racial segregation, but there is something about a society where there was middle class expansion and there was that was exceptionally American. We were the first mass middle class society, and as I understand our history, you know, it what's part of our civic DNA is this rejection of hereditary wealth and power. This idea of you would be born into a station in life that would give you vast privilege. We like to think what you do matters more than where you're born. But I think you're right that in the last 30 years, the culture is shifting, that we are becoming more individualistic, extremely individualistic, where there has been that breakdown in solidarity, where we don't really see what happens to our neighbor as mattering to us. And we're putting it all on the altar of the market. We're sort of saying we're willing to gamble it all so that we can have our individual security, even if our neighbors sink. So that when you ask the question about the rest of the world, again, the United States, when we were founded, the rest of the country, world were caste societies. Where you were born is where you died. You didn't move up or down. You stayed where you were. And the United States had this very different kind of ethos, and now the United States we're having hardening of the arteries in terms of mobility, and for the first time in the last 10-15 years, we're starting to see European countries being more mobile, having more mobility within the society than the U.S. So we're trading places, and I think Professor Wilson alluded to that there's some ways in which the United States is becoming more like old Europe, old caste society Europe. And there's ways in which Europe is becoming more of a mobile society.
How should the presidential candidates address this? I mean, write the speech for Obama demanding change. Write the speech for John McCain justifying the trend.
Well, I've seen them both make denunciations of excessive pay, you know, the fact that the chief executive officer can earn more in a day than their average worker earns in a year. So they're everybody's on the bandwagon, that there's something wrong with that. John McCain might talk about how we should eliminate subsidies that preference one industry over another that unlevel the playing field, but that in fact what makes America great, these inequalities provide incentives for people to get out there and work and strive, and that's and that if you
and the investment capital perhaps
investment capital and if you mess with the machinery that both creates those inequalities, you will also hurt the machinery that creates our dynamic economic potential. So I think that's sort of the speech, although it's very interesting. David Frum, a Republican speechwriter, just had a piece in the New York Times Magazine recently where he argued that actually the GOP, by virtue of not addressing these issues of inequality, is starting to lose some of their base, meaning that there are people in the exurbs that have voted Republican historically, who were part of the middle class expansion that did well in the 80s and 90s, but are starting to stall out economically. They're realizing that their savings is eroding, that the wealth in their home has vanished, and that maybe government needs to play a little bit more role in the economy to keep people from falling through the floor. And I think there is a debate within the Republican community, and I don't think John McCain is part of that, although I think in the past he has been part of that, talking about what's really happening. To the middle class, the Reagan Democrats who voted Republican for a couple of years are going to start to, the pendulum may switch back, and they might start to say, you know what, maybe we need a government to intervene both to protect opportunity and to protect us from extreme inequality.
How would Barack Obama speak to the truth of the matter and maybe get some of the Reagan Democrats back?
I think he needs to tell the story of what's happened, not only what's happened to the middle class, but why inequality matters. That when we pull apart the way we are, that it has economic costs. It's bad for the economy. It's bad. It destabilizes the economy because...
Prove it.
Well, the prosperity of the last 20 years is for middle class people has been based on debt. It's not been based on real wage growth. How have people survived with the stagnant wages of the last 20 years, 30 years? They have borrowed more, and they've worked more hours. Well, the gig is up. People are unable to borrow more, and they're maxed out in terms of the number of hours they can work. So too much inequality means that working people don't have the money in their pocket to stimulate the economy. But here's the other part that isn't talked about. At the top end, the super rich have so much money that they begin to chase more and more speculative, unreal investments. They begin to look to earn returns, high returns, not 5%, 10%, 15%, but 20%, 30% returns, and that pushes them into this highly speculative sector of the economy. So what the super rich investment class has done is they invested in technology, and that bubble burst. Then they said, well, we're not going to invest in that. We're going to invest in real estate. And so then there was all this speculative investment in real estate. Now that's burst. Now it's moving into commodities, food and oil and other staples. Well, when you have speculation at the top and insufficient spending power in the middle, you have a prescription for a very unstable economy. If I were going to say it in a very simple, if I was Barack Obama, I would just say too much inequality creates basic instability in the economy. Working people don't have the power to buy things, and at the very top, there's too much speculation, and that really hurts the economy.
You're in the analytical and advocacy end of a story that a lot of people are talking about, Chuck Collins. How's it going? What's the direction? What's the progress of your own work?
Well, I think 15 years ago, we talked about the picture. We were just trying to get people to pay attention to the picture. Look at what's happening. We're pulling apart. We're becoming more unequal. Wealth is concentrating in this top 1%. And the national conversation was kind of along the lines of, we don't see it. We don't agree. We dispute the picture.
The doubts about global warming.
Now, I would say there's progress, which is the national conversation recognizes there are these extreme inequalities. I mean, David Frum here in the New York Times is writing about it. Ben Bernanke, President Bush, everybody's acknowledged that we've become a more unequal society. Now the debate is over, does it matter? You know, does it matter that some people have so much and some people have so little? Everyone probably agrees poverty matters, but does how rich the rich are matter? And there's a good debate about that. And I think we have not won the hearts and minds of the public in terms of fully seeing the costs to the health of the society, the economy, democracy, of too much inequality. But the other then debate is over what to do about it. I mean, you know, how did it happen and what to do about it? And that's where I think, you know, there's a beginning to be a better, more robust conversation about 30 years of tax policies that sort of privileged asset owners. You know, we cut capital gains and dividend taxes. Payroll taxes have continued to go up. So we've overtaxed work and undertaxed wealth. We've had trade policies that have done a great job boosting shareholder value, but not helping workers in this country. Our trade policies have sort of pit U.S. workers against Chinese workers or Mexican workers and who can lower their wages. So I think there's a beginning to understand that the rules, it's not just about individuals. The rules of the society got sort of tipped one way, and that if we want to have a more equal society, the rules have to encourage broader growth, shared prosperity. And I actually think in the next 2-3 years, these issues of inequality will come front and center even more than they are. Part of it's that I don't think that the economy is going to improve anytime in the short term, so you're going to start to see more households falling off the edge. The cost of fuel is not going to go down. People are not going to be able to borrow for their basic survival, so that will create a reckoning. There'll be a reckoning. My paycheck doesn't match my expenses. The kind of grotesqueness of the lushness of some of life in Richistan and life for the rest of America will become starker. What Robert Frank did in his book, which really looks at this new world of the super rich, is he said, you know, they've created their own universe, really. It's a Richistan. And I think that will lead to movements among wealthy people who recognize that, to speak out about it, you know, and devote philanthropic dollars and to become a moral force there, you know. But there will also be social movements that will be saying, you know, we want an economy that works for everybody. But they live in a totally different world now than the rest of their fellow citizens. And part of, you know, the American experiment is at risk, you know, because of that delinking of Richistan. Because Richistan not only has a lot of wealth, I mean, it has a lot of the ability to pay taxes and to contribute philanthropic money to the society, they have a lot of clout, because in our democracy, they're using their money to defend their privilege. And that's where the distortions kind of contribute. So it's like the advantages kind of keep piling up, like interest, and the disadvantages for some people in the society keep compounding, like your credit card debt, you know. And so you have compounding advantage and disadvantage when the wealthy use their power and clout to rig the rules so they keep getting more power and clout. And I think that's where the inequalities begin to be dangerous to the fabric of the society.
Chuck Collins, I've admired so much of your writing, and I love your website, extremeinequality.org. Thank you, Chuck Collins.
Thanks for the conversation.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Add your own two bits on the inequality issue or the trend of American exceptions in this world at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thanks for joining us.